This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week, President Bush left no doubt the date for the transfer of sovereignty in Iraq will be June 30th. The composition, structure, and powers of the interim Iraqi government, though, have yet to be determined. And later this hour, we'll focus on how all of that is going to be decided and what will actually change. Toward the end of the program, we'll talk about the shift of American policy in the Middle East after President Bush endorsed Israeli plans to withdraw from Gaza and parts of the West Bank yesterday. But first, the volatile situation in Iraq. April has been the deadliest month to date. What's happening at the flashpoints of Fallujah and Najaf and how the continuing violence will affect the handover. We'll take your questions about the June 30th handover date later in the program. If you have questions now about security or about the fighting in Fallujah in particular, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is New York Times reporter Jeffrey Gettleman. He's been covering the fighting in Fallujah and other spots in Iraq. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
You reported in this morning's edition of the paper that fighting in Fallujah has been a door-to-door combat in the night times, this all during a period when there's supposed to be a ceasefire.
Yeah, what we're seeing is sort of exactly what American officials warned, and that is an increase in violence leading up to the June 30th transfer of power. In Fallujah, it's still pretty bad, even though there is an official cessation of offensive operations by the American Marines, who occupy bits of Fallujah and the surrounding area. Over the last few nights, I've been embedded with the Marines, and I've seen intense urban combat myself. A number of Marine positions have come under fire at night by RPGs, which are rocket-propelled grenades, long bursts of machine gun fire, mortar fire, and other gunfire from machine guns and assault rifles. It's been pretty frightening, and it doesn't look like there's any sign that it's lightening up.
From what we have heard, the ceasefire described by a Marine spokesman is that the Marines are on the defensive and they only respond to attacks. Is that the way it looks from the ground?
Well, in the city of Fallujah, that's basically the case. The Marines were pushing into Fallujah last week, and on Saturday they got orders to abruptly halt their offensive operations. So what they did was establish a perimeter in certain parts of the city that that marked the large bits of territory that they controlled. They don't go any farther than that perimeter right now. But on that front line, they receive a lot of attacks from Iraqi insurgents. So what they do is they fire back from the rooftops and from positions along the perimeter, but they're not going forward at all. But along that perimeter, the fighting is quite intense. It's been going on every day. The earth shakes from mortar rounds. You hear artillery and heavy machine gun fire constantly. And it looks like the insurgents are sort of organizing better and have more ambitious plans to attack the Americans over the last few days.
Both sides, are they digging in at this point, preparing positions for what we keep hearing from Marine commanders as well, as if the situation may deteriorate and the ceasefire may break down?
Yeah, and what's interesting is it looks a lot like, you know, the fighting here is almost a throwback to World War II or previous conflicts like that. The Marines have occupied a number of homes, and they've established almost like catwalks from roof to roof, and they fortified the roofs of many of these homes with sandbags and fighting positions, and they stick their guns out overlooking the hostile territory where the insurgents occupy. The insurgents, on the other hand, are on rooftops across the street with many of their own fighting positions, and at night, under the cover of darkness, the two sides go at it. The Marines haven't suffered many casualties because they're very well hunkered down. They wear the protective gear with the Kevlar helmets and the bulletproof vests, and they seem to be pretty well trained in urban combat. The insurgents, however, are increasingly bold. Sometimes they run into the streets, and that's when they get killed by the Marines. Other times they launch these ambitious attacks, and the Marines respond either with gunfire from their positions or by calling in helicopters or fixed-wing aircraft to bomb where the insurgents are. But what's interesting is that it really is a classic urban warfare scenario on a scale that American forces really haven't seen since World War II.
A classic urban warfare is a extracts high penalties on the civilian population. Fallujah is a city of about 200,000, 300,000 people in normal times. What's been happening to them?
Well, I think a lot of people there got the message to get out. The Marines were laying siege to the city last week, and during that time they were allowing civilians to leave. So there was this long stream of people and battered cars and taxis, sometimes dragging their belongings through the streets themselves, who left Fallujah right before the fighting got intense. So right now, in the areas where there's heavy fighting, it's this eerie ghost town where you almost see no activity on the street, no life, no people playing, no stores open, no schools open, none of the mosques in some of these areas have even the call to prayer, which is a ubiquitous sound in almost every neighborhood in Iraq. So I think the Marines did a pretty good job of clearing out the civilians, and the insurgents, too, often, before they launch an attack, tell civilians to stay out of the streets. So it's hard to tell the civilian casualty toll from my perspective, because I've been embedded with the Marines, and around them there are few civilians. However, we have heard reports from Iraqi doctors and hospital staff that there were civilians injured in bombings in some of the larger attacks during the siege. But right now, there really isn't a lot of these large attacks. It's more this sort of sporadic gun battles, and you're not seeing too many civilian casualties, at least I haven't, since the ceasefire was declared.
How are the Marines reacting to the prospect of having to possibly resume this door-to-door, building-to-building combat, which has been very expensive in American blood before the ceasefire?
Well, you know, the Marines like to be on the offense. Almost every Marine you talk to, from the lowest grunt, as they call them, to the highest commander, emphasizes the fact that Marines are very mobile. They're here to launch assaults, and they're here to sort of move fast and take territory. So I think a lot of them were frustrated on Saturday when they were, you know, making great progress through the city. They had a lot of momentum to all of a sudden get the orders to halt. However, halting allows them to gather more intelligence, to fortify their supply lines, to build up positions, to get a better read of the city, so they can use the time to their advantage. However, so can the insurgents, and one of the worries is the insurgents have been able to sort of better fortify themselves. They're able to get more supplies, more ammunition, more food, more water. So the fear is, because of this halt, both sides have been allowed to build up, and if there is a resumption of hostilities, it could be really bloody and really long.
Let's get a caller on the line. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. Tom is with us from Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Hi, I had a question about what was the rush to go into Fallujah? Why didn't we just let all the civilians leave? Now, that's good information. I didn't realize that before. And then just surround the city and then kind of wait it out and then attack the other areas of that we're looking at, instead of just going in and just door-to-door fighting in Fallujah.
Well, I think that's a good question. The rationale for going into Fallujah in the first place was the attack on four American security guards about 2 weeks ago. And this was this infamous moment where the four American security consultants were driving through downtown Fallujah. Their cars were ambushed with gunfire. They were killed, and then their bodies were pulled out of the cars, dragged through the streets, and hung from a bridge over the Euphrates River. That was the rationale for going into Fallujah in the first place. Why the Marines didn't wait to clear out the entire city of civilians isn't clear. I think they did notify civilians ahead of the siege via loudspeaker and other methods to get out. So I think they figured that anybody who stayed in the city could possibly be an insurgent. They also didn't want to forecast their attack by too much time, and I'm just sort of, you know, thinking this through now as you ask the question, but my guess is that they wouldn't want to say, hey, we're going to attack the city in 2 weeks, because one, that would give people time to escape, and two, that would give people time to dig in.
Tom, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Jeffrey, as we move on in today's show, we're going to be talking a lot about the deadline coming up on June 30th. As you travel in and out of Fallujah, and certainly the convoys in and out of Fallujah are sometimes as dangerous as Fallujah itself, I'm wondering, how aware are Iraqi civilians of this deadline?
You know, where I am in the Sunni Triangle, in the sort of bitter heart of the resistance, I don't think it's that big an issue. Right now, all eyes are focused on the siege of Fallujah and what's going to happen if the Marines go back in. I was with a Marine company today that was on that took some time to go on these search and destroy missions today through the farmland around Fallujah. And it was really dangerous. I mean, there was gunfire everywhere. We got ambushed a number of times. And I got the sense that the number one issue here was sort of the American presence and the occupation itself. And that's really not going to change on June 30th. What's going to change on June 30th is sort of the official recognition of the Governing Council as being the lead authority in Iraq, as opposed to the CPA, or the Coalition Provisional Authority, headed by Paul Bremer. But the military issue is going to remain the exact same. The Iraqi security forces have shown that they're not able to really maintain order and stability in Iraq, and the American military is going to have to continue its heavy presence here. So I think, you know, that the people of Iraq, especially in an area like this, are more focused on the military and what they're doing as opposed to what's happening in Baghdad with the official recognition of the Governing Council.
Jeffrey Gettleman, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Gettleman is a reporter for The New York Times, and we spoke to him today in Fallujah in Iraq. And joining us now is Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. He joins us from their studio. Michael, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be with you. Thanks.
Everybody mentions, and again, we're going to focus on June 30th in a moment, but in the time we have left in this segment, security is a huge issue for politics and everything else in Iraq. With violence there continuing, how is this security going to be, how is that security issue going to be, and especially given the role of Iraqi forces in various guises, police, security forces, Iraqi army, who have been such a disappointment in the past couple of weeks?
Well, that's really a key point, because we all have watched and know that the violence has continued and in some ways even intensified, not just the last 2 weeks, but frankly this whole calendar year. There was a lot of use of truck bombing, as you know, against civilian populations. And so the headlines have been very bad. But what we had all hoped was that beneath the surface, there was this gradual improvement in the Iraqi security forces, so that if nothing else, the strategy of Iraqification, so to speak, would work, that we'd be able to turn over responsibility for a lot of the policing and eventually even the counterinsurgency operation to Iraqi security forces. That's still obviously the goal, but now it appears that it may be a year, two, 3 years longer in the making or in the achieving than we had hoped. So I think instead of being able to aspire to getting American forces out of Iraq in, let's say, 2006, 2007, now we're starting to recognize we're basically here for the decade, if not longer, and that's a pretty sober thought.
And that the training of Iraqi forces is not going to be a simple or a quick process.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, Michael O'Hanlon, stay with us. When we come back from the break, we're also going to be joined by John Alterman, who is with us from the director of the Middle East program at CSIS, and take your questions about the broader issues that come up between now and June 30th, and then what really changes in Iraq on July the 1st. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Initially, the Bush administration hoped that Iraqis would select representatives of an interim government in regional caucuses. That plan collapsed amid criticism that an unelected government would have no legitimacy. The administration then asked the United Nations to try to resolve disputes over the transfer of power. UN representatives concluded that elections are not possible before January of next year, but that the transfer of sovereignty to an interim government should go ahead on the 30th of June. Yesterday, UN Special Envoy Lakhdar Brahimi proposed a structure for that government at a news conference in Baghdad.
The aim should be, at present, is to put in place a caretaker government that will be in charge from the 1st of July 2004 until those elections in January 2005. We are confident that it will be possible to form such a government in a timely manner, that is, during the month of May 2004. We see it as a government led by a prime minister and comprising Iraqi men and women known for their honesty, integrity, and competence. There will also be a president to act as head of state and two vice presidents.
The UN Special Envoy will take his proposal to the United Nations to discuss with the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, and then that proposal will be discussed with the President of the United States. But 10 weeks from the deadline, the shape, powers, and leadership of an interim government all remains undecided. If you have questions about the challenges between today and June 30th, how life in Iraq may change on July 1st, and how all this may affect American troops, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution is still with us on the line, and joining us now is John Alterman, Director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's with us here in Studio 3. Very good of you to come in today.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
As you look at that structure outlined by Mr. Brahimi yesterday, it sounds a lot like the structure that was outlined in the proposed Iraqi constitution.
It does. What I find interesting is what he said next after the clip you ran is that the governing council ceases to exist. So there's a transition. What we heard in November was we think the governing council isn't going to be viable. We have to find a new institution.
Mm-hmm.
What we see now is a very clear plan that the people who are going to put the governing council out of its misery is going to be the UN, and the UN will be the agency that names a new set of leaders who will take Iraq through this interim period until elections next January.
And would it be your assumption that the current memberships of a membership, the people who are on the governing council now, would not be in these senior positions that he was describing?
At the very end of the press conference, he said not necessarily members of the governing council. What we presume is that there's been some sort of decision made, some sort of deal made with many members of the governing council, where some would stay on board and some would go away. And what that looks like and whether they're upset about it and who's upset about not being brought on board in this new process is a very, very difficult and delicate thing. And we really don't know enough details yet.
Michael O'Hanlon, one of the factors that's going on here is almost a transfer of authority from the American point of view, from the Defense Department, the Pentagon, to the State Department. It wouldn't be a coalition authority anymore. It would be an American embassy on July the 1st. One of the things that the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, has always said that he's had a big role in naming that governing council in Iraq and seemingly a stake in perpetuating it.
That's right. And many are saying this is potentially a victory for Secretary Powell. If we get the current U.N. ambassador to be our new ambassador to Iraq, that's a man close to him. And so I am hopeful that, frankly, a State Department that has called a lot of the shots much more accurately than the Pentagon, especially since last April 9th, will have more influence. I hope very much that's the case. So we will see. One last point, if I could add to your previous discussion with John, I think an interesting question about who stays and who goes from the governing council is whether or not you will be allowed to be a candidate for elected office next year if you stay on this caretaker government this year. So some people may have an incentive to step down if indeed they are otherwise prohibited from running for office next year. I don't know any of the details of this. John may, but that's one of the questions that occurs to me.
And John, do you know details of that?
I don't know many details, and Lakhdar Brahimi was fairly elusive. I think this is something we're going to have to see unfold over the coming week or so.
The powers of this new government are also at issue. Earlier we played a clip of from another part of the news conference about what does sovereignty mean in this context, and he said, well, it means an end to the legal occupation, but he also noted that 150,000 soldiers aren't exactly going away. What does what would this Iraqi interim government control? John, what do you think?
Well, a lot of it depends on whether people have faith in their ability to represent Iraqi interests. And I think one of the problems, not knowing who they're talking about and how they might structure this, that arises in my mind first is if you have a lot of technocrats, people who are personally skilled but aren't used to inspiring people, are they going to be the ones who are going to bring Iraqis around to saying, yes, this is my future? Because technocrats aren't good at that. technocrats have advantages over politicians, but it's important to remember as well, technocrats have disadvantages over politicians too. And ultimately, we need a political success for Iraqis to rise up and say, yes, this is my future, and embrace it.
Let's get a caller on the line, and Eric is with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question for your guest. You know, if some kind of government is going to be sovereign in Iraq after June 30th, what does that mean for relations with the U.S. military? What if, for example, this sovereign government decides to order the U.S. military out? How can there actually be a sovereign government with it when the occupation is still there?
Michael O'Hanlon?
Well, I think you're...